Boyd. Up next on Think, the forgotten black history of brewers and beer. We'll spend this hour with James Bennett II talking about pre-colonial beer styles in West Africa, their use in social and religious rituals, and evidence that American slave traders eagerly marketed brewing as a value-added skill of some enslaved people. We'll talk about how European immigrants and their white descendants came to be associated with fondness for craft ales and lagers in the American imagination, and hear about some black brewers reconnecting with their ancestors' beer traditions in the 21st century. Our conversation starts after a short break. That somebody is really into craft beer, especially when I hear that person has taken up brewing craft beer, I'll admit I tend to picture somebody who looks like an extra from Portlandia or a background mandolin player from Mumford & Sons, which is to say a youngish hipster white guy, possibly wearing cuffed jeans with suspenders and a funky hat. But that image eliminates the many centuries of contributions made to brewing by people of African descent, and it's high time we knew more about that. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. James Bennett II is a staff writer for classical radio station WQXR. He notes that the widespread and inaccurate perception that black Americans aren't really into beer erases the role black people have played in shaping and satisfying our taste for beer. And he's discovered that some of the most innovative, up-and-coming craft breweries out there today are run by black brewers. His essay, "We're Reclaiming Beer Because It's Ours," appears at the website Eater. James, welcome to Think.
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm well, thank you. How did you start to become aware of all the interesting things happening among black brewers and entrepreneurs who are making and selling these specialty beers?
Well, the interest wasn't, you know, a day where I woke up and said, I'm going to find out who the black folks are that are making beer. It kind of started in two separate, you know, threads. The first is that I live in Flatbush. There is a brewery nearby where I live that I like to go hang out at sometimes, you know, especially before the pandemic hit. And that is black owned. There was another one only a few blocks away from me that was also black owned. So I knew that there was a black presence in the craft beer scene. But the reason why I really started peeling back the layers of this and getting into the history and the storytelling was a very simple question that I had, which is, why is Heineken the black beer? I might have mentioned it to friends as a bit of a joke, but, you know, looking through or listening to, let's say, 90s hip hop, for instance, you're going to hear a lot of Heineken reference being dropped, Beck's too. And when I'm at social functions, you know, family and friends, beer isn't a major presence there. And if there is beer, I am willing to bet some cash that I may or may not have that Heineken will be there. So what started me on this thing was like, what is going on? How come there's a perception that black people don't drink beer? How come beer is not in refrigerators at family and friends' houses? But when there is beer on these special occasions, it's going to be the stuff in the green bottle.
All right, so let's start to untangle that. Today's black brewers are drawing on traditions that go back thousands of years. What can we know about beer making in Africa before European colonization and the slave trade?
Yeah, so one thing that I was able to pick up during this research is that fermented beverages in general, so we can think beer, we can think palm wine, you know, whatever you have, that played an outsized role in religious and spiritual function. So one of the folks I was able to talk to, right, Michael Twitty, who is this great food historian and just so knowledgeable about African and African-American foodways, was telling me that, you know, the consumption, the production, the fermentation of these drinks, which included beer, were really cemented into ritual spiritual practice. And that is a big part of identity for people, you know, the world over. One's spirituality, one's connection to religion, one's connection to the community. And sure, I guess that, you know, people hundreds of years ago would drink this as an enjoyable thing, but it did serve that, for lack of a better phrase, higher function.
What ingredients would African brewers have had at their disposal?
Yeah, so like I had said, I didn't really get into the mechanics of exactly, you know, what was going into that, you know, into those products. But one thing that I did see that kept popping up, right, are things like, you know, palm wine, right? You know, those, you know, the fermentation, you know, of that being kind of a, I wouldn't say a go-to, but it kept coming up enough in the conversations and like in the research that it seemed to be, I guess, a, you know, a standard kind of a practice or something. But what I did think was interesting was I talked to, you know, one of the brewers at Sankofa Beer Company, which is down in, which is down in DC. And what their whole kind of idea of practice is to bring, you know, West African brewing practices to American, you know, brewing conventions, right? So, you know, including things like cocoa and hibiscus and stuff like that kind of informs how they're creating their beers.
Were early African Muslims drinking beer back in ancient times?
Yeah, so again, like I wasn't there. So I can't say for sure. One thing that speaks to that directly, again, you know, back on this piece, you know, Twitty was telling me about his own kind of, you know, research on the continent of Africa, specifically visiting a Dakar village in Cameroon, where a lot of folks in that community do identify as Muslim. And, you know, the consumption of alcoholic beverages is haram. You know, it's not really allowed in the religion, for lack of a better phrase. But because there's such this, there's this long history, right, of libation being tied to spiritual practices, you know, that is a, that's a holdover in a way of ancient spirituality, more recent, you know, even though that, you know, Islam is on the scene in the 7th century, 8th century, it's a holdover. It's like, okay, we're Muslim, but there is still going to be this ceremonial vessel of this traditional fermented beer product.
And you draw this line from that, you know, special occasion to the way African Americans maybe think about beer today. It is a treat, or it's a special occasion drink. It's not something that you necessarily grab every Saturday after mowing the lawn.
Yeah, I grew up in a suburb on the border of Baltimore City and County. And whenever anyone in the house is doing housework on a Saturday, right, no one's coming in, wiping the sweat off of their brow and saying, wow, it is time for a beer. That was unheard of to me. And when I moved to New York when I was 17 and just see people casually swilling beers, it's just, what? Like, that's a thing? So yeah, it was a very special occasion. It was both special occasion for certain functions that I would find myself in as a child and as an early teenager. And at the same time, it was also, I guess, implied that this is a food product that is not meant for us. So again, yeah, the idea of having just a six pack in your fridge just because, to me, was foreign. And if I did see it, then I knew something was going to happen that involved a lot of people and a lot of delicious food.
Like a barbecue or a family holiday, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And even at that, you know, it's not, it's, nothing's monolithic in this sense, right? So that beer that would show up would be from relatives who were visiting, some from the Midwest, where I guess, you know, beer consumption might be a bit more, quote unquote, stereotypical.
So if American beer culture overlaps with white culture in the popular imagination, what does that look like?
Just to make sure I get the question right, you're asking what does beer culture overlapped with white American culture look like to just, I guess, a quote-unquote average American?
Right.
Right. So I guess there's three lenses or ideas that exist in this way. The first one would be, and this is just my perception of things. The first would be your blue collar, working class, old school throwback Rust Belt worker at like the second season of The Wire, right? All the Seaborgs hanging out. Yeah, exactly. In the harbor after a hard day's work, cracking eggs into beers for breakfast, or just enjoying, some kind of union camaraderie with one another, right? So there's that. But then there's also the youth. This idea of I don't know, like what's the movie I'm thinking of? I can't remember it, but just that idea
Animal
of
House.
Animal House, there we go. Yeah. Also not Dazed and Confused, maybe Dazed and Confused or Kicking and Screaming, but like these late teenagers, early 20s, were in a fraternity house or in kind of a college-y social club. We're going to go and get, a 30 rack of beer and have a good time, even though this beer does not particularly taste good. And then there's this third tranche of beer consumption, popular imagination, which is what you mentioned at the top of the hour, right? These folks that are in, these Henleys and this plaid and, with these mustaches. It's very male, very, male dominated, white dominated, hirsute, in gentrified neighborhoods in these fancy bars with their really sour craft beers or really funky IPAs that are swilling this $10-$12 a glass beverage, clocking in at 6, 7, 8, 9% ABV. And kind of going back to this idea that I had as a kid that, oh, that beer thing isn't really for us. All three of those, to some extent, don't include, non-white people, let alone black people at all.
All right, so how did it happen that many parts of Europe that might once have actually had thriving winemaking traditions switched to beer starting in the 1300s?
Yeah, so I found this really interesting, and I had no idea about this going in. This kind of cropped up during interviews and research, and I just thought, wow, this explains something. Right. So if we're thinking about the popular image of beer drinkers being European, being white, you have to think, right? How did it get that way? Why is beer the European thing? And one of the things that popped up was this scientific climatological phenomenon of the Little Ice Age. And so you have grapes being grown in these regions of Northern Europe, even in places like Britain, right? Which we do not think about as producing the finest wines. Not saying that no one produces wines in Britain or they don't have great wines in the UK. I'm not saying that, but it is not the popular image if we're being honest with ourselves. So there's this period of global cooling that is going down at the beginning of the I think 14th century, lasting for hundreds of years thereafter. And one of the consequences of that is the grape production just declines. I mean, the soil and the climate does not allow for wine grapes, that is, to be grown for fermentation for wine. But what you can grow are hardier grains. You can grow things like hops, things that you would imagine and that are essential to beer making. And so I don't want to say it's just from a wine economy to a beer economy, but let's just say that the agricultural vibe was more suited to start brewing more beer.
All right, James, so the age of exploration happens. Europeans start sailing around the world in search of trade goods. They seem to think it is their right to steal human beings from everything they've ever known and trade them as well. Some of those people, those enslaved Africans, would have had knowledge of cultivating the grains to make beer and making beer, and this would have made them, if you'll pardon the expression, more valuable to people trading them to other people.
Yeah, I mean, there's this idea, I think, that prevails. And I think it's a very stupid idea that people on the African continent that were kidnapped and enslaved and sent to the Western Hemisphere didn't know anything, right? There's this idea that the institution of slavery, it's bringing them into this enlightened age and is, you know, all for the better for them. And that never really sat right with me for a lot of reasons. But one of them is that it's like these societies have existed for, you know, centuries, for millennia, and you're telling me that they don't know how to do anything at all. And so when you see these enslaved Africans first arriving in what is later the United States, right, they're bringing all of that cultural and culinary and religious and social knowledge with them that is being forcibly transplanted, you know, from West Africa to the East Coast and the southern parts of the US. And so it's only natural in a way that that seeps in to how that work and how that labor is being performed and exploited. And so, yeah, I mean, I think you had mentioned earlier that some of the laborious tasks that were foisted upon these people did play to some of those, for lack of a better word, strengths, right? There were Black enslaved folk that had a very good and firm grasp on how fermentation and those processes worked. You know, there's no reason, right, why Thomas Jefferson would put Peter Hemings in charge of brewing beer if Peter Hemings had no idea what he was doing. There's no reason why you could see, you know, a wanted ad for a quote unquote fugitive slave who was could be described as, you know, a brewer or some kind of advertisement hyping up their skills at brewing if they had no idea what they were doing. So yeah, they're bringing that along with them, and they're you know, building, dare I say, the American economy with it.
At the same time, slaveholders used beer to keep enslaved people from getting away during times when I guess overseers were not working or couldn't be relied on to sort of watch them every minute.
Yeah, this was really interesting, and it's a very, I don't want to say nuanced, because I feel that gives it license to be like, oh, it was okay. But there's a lot to unpack with that idea. The first is this. When you are kidnapping and enslaving people, you kind of have to tell yourself anything you can in order to sleep at night. At least I would believe that. And so what you come across are two competing narratives about the function that that fermented beverages and alcohol can play for the enslaved soul. On one hand, there is this argument or school of thought that is, okay, if we do not allow them to drink, then they will remain uninhibited and, you know, they will remain a bit, I don't know, docile, and they won't unlock this extra level of Negro strength that allegedly exists or whatever. But on the other, it's like, wait, but if you do give them alcohol, then they're going to get so drunk they can't even begin to plot routes of escape. That's actually something that comes up in some autobiographical works from Frederick Douglass, right, who is observing how, or recalling rather, the function that play, the function that whiskey, for instance, would play on the plantation, where he would say, yeah, they're giving this to these, you know, Black folks on holidays, at Christmas and at New Year's, so that during this break from the work, they can't channel that energy into something more productive, like, I don't know, living a more fulfilled and freer life. So yeah, that is something that I find particularly interesting, because they come to direct conflict with each other, and it's very evident that whoever is in charge of enslaving these people and upholding these systems institutions are saying whatever it takes to justify what they're doing.
And then there was politics at work as well, because there was a really close association between the abolitionist movement and the temperance movement.
There was. And what's funny about temperance is that I feel if you take a snapshot of temperance in, let's say, like the 1840s or 50s or, you know, even into the 1860s up to the Civil War, there is this idea that teetotalers, that temperance activists in the North are pushing, that fermented beverages, alcoholic beverages, are to be demonized because it is giving this license, this immoral license to white people to enslave their fellow human. And that comes up in a lot of abolitionist propaganda and activism work. It comes up in fiction. I think, you know, in Uncle Tom's Cabin, right? One of the characters gets really drunk and then beats a slave to death. And what you kind of see is an aligning of abolition of temperance against intemperance and slavery. And again, you know, coming back to Frederick Douglass, and I bring him up a lot just because I think he wrote extensively, or pretty extensively, relatively speaking, on the subject of temperance, of abolition, oftentimes together, and of his own kind of journey to teetotalism and his own relationship with alcohol. What's weird, though, is eventually after the Civil War, especially in the South, you see these temperance movements crop up in opposition to social equality and equity. And the politics of that are, you know, again, if these newly freed Black people start drinking, they might wreak havoc across the, you know, genteel Southern countryside. There's this fear that because sometimes these drinking houses and saloons, you know, or just like the idea of just opening up a bottle with a fellow resident, right? It's this mixing, it's this race mixing that the power brokers in especially the Southern United States, right, did not at all want to brook or tolerate. And so it's like, you know what? What if we just don't drink anything at all, and we'll keep Black folks in check, and we'll prevent them from hanging out with other white people. Hmm.
All right. So starting in, you know, the last quarter of the 19th century, you have this huge influx of European immigration, including Germans, some of whom come over and decide to start commercial breweries. Why would those immigrants not have hired experienced Black brewers who might have wanted the job?
Yeah. So what's OK, so you have this wave of Central European immigrants, especially. I mean, this idea, right, of, you know, Anheuser-Busch and Schlitz and Pabst, all these very Germanic names. They're showing up in the United States, especially in the Midwest, before the Great Migration, right, before the wave of, you know, Afro-American relocation to places like Detroit, places like Chicago. And what they're doing at first, right, is they're setting up their own cultural enclave. You know, I would say it might be akin to what we would call, it might see like a Chinatown, or, you know, here in Brooklyn, like, you know, Little Haiti or something like that, or Petite Senegal, like up in Harlem, right? So there is this space for these recently arrived German immigrants to hang out, to drink the beer that they're familiar with from back home, to read German newspapers, to talk in their own German tongue, to discuss, you know, politics or like whatever with other people from their ethnic background. And so, you know, part of the whole American thing is it's everything is capitalism, right? Everything kind of comes back to that. And if you want to make it in America, what do people tell you to do, right? You know, start a business or something. And so if you have these people with a very rich beer tradition showing up in the United States, and it's like, okay, what do we do? Why don't we start commercializing, you know, our beer production? This also kind of comes in tandem, I think, with the emergence of better technology, you know, to bottle and to preserve and to transport, you know, this beer. You know, the lagering process, I think, requires, you know, a bit of a, you know, chillier temperature. So you got refrigerators and stuff that can help this along. And so you're creating these, I guess, for, you know, lack of a better word, like American businesses. And it's just almost by default, it's not going to be welcoming, right, to the American underclass. And also think about it this way too. It's like, you have these unions, right? You have these people that are working in these breweries and they're joining these unions. And these unions, they have these practices that are just like, okay, in our union, we're not going to hire any Black folk at all. So it's kind of just baked in, right, to the ethos of American commercialism and capitalism, especially at the turn of the century. And if I just can kind of bring in too this idea that before that, when things were being brewed, things like beer, things like, I guess wine to some extent as well, that was being brewed in the home, oftentimes by, in the case of at least, Black folk, by Black women. Like that was being brewed for use at home, not for commercial distribution. And so when you start to get these big companies that are creating this for mass consumption, that is kind of marking an end to this era of, oh yeah, everybody has their own recipe, everyone has their own, I don't know what you call it, a keg or a barrel full of cider or beer that's hanging out outside of the house. Because you can just go to a store now, pick it up and buy it, and it'll probably save you money and time in the long run. If, let's be real, you can even walk into that store.
All right, another major component of the sort of beer is a white thing belief is that major beer brands in this country, as production began to be commercialized, they were marketing to white audiences. How did the end of Prohibition shift the ways that beer producers wanted to define their product?
So I would wind it a little bit back if I can to
Okay.
the end of World War I first. So right before Prohibition, right? So after World War I, there's this, or during World War I especially, right? There's this wave of anti-German sentiment in the United States. Oh, you're German, you're bad, you support the bad guys. Buzz off. And after that's all done, you get Prohibition. And that is, legally shutting down all of these breweries and distilleries in the United States, right? So after Prohibition's over, you have, if you're, let's say, a company like Pabst, for instance, or one of these bigger breweries that are descended from these immigrant entrepreneurs, you have a kind of, I wouldn't say a crisis, but you have some strategic thinking to do. You've just come off of a wave of everyone hating you and a wave of the state saying you can't do your work. And the idea, right, is that this can't happen again. And the outcome of that is we have to kind of cozy up to, again, that American, the white American pathos that we're one of you. It's just a full on, let's just integrate and assimilate fully into this broad artificial matrix-like construct of quote unquote whiteness. Hey, we're not foreign, we're not German, we're American just like you. So why don't you drink, one of our beers and have a good time, fellow white person? And when you're doing that, well, you're not going to be advertising to folks that look like me.
All right. So then World War II happens, and after it's over, there's just a sudden craze for mixed drinks. How did U.S. breweries try to compete with that if everybody wanted, a Tom Collins or whatever?
I don't know like the mechanics of exactly what went down to make everyone after World War II get really into I don't know, Mai Tais or old fashions. One thing that I did see was that white flight to the suburbs meant you had a lot more space. They could build a home bar, so you could actually keep the equipment around to make this stuff. So yeah, so that was another, I guess, damper on the beer industry. How do you compete when you have a 5% beer with, something that's packing a bit more of a boozy punch, pun not intended. So what you start seeing in the industry is the creation of this fabulous carbonated, bubbly, really, really, really strong style of beer with these wonderful names like Old English and Country Club and Private Sock. Right, I'm talking about malt liquor. Malt liquor is created to compete directly with the spirit and with this cocktail culture. Problem is, the malt liquor doesn't exactly taste great. So, good luck spending a lot of money on advertising a product saying that it is refreshing and delicious when some could argue the counter.
All right, so white drinkers didn't love malt liquor. Presumably, black drinkers didn't love it either, but they were really targeted by advertising. Let's listen to a 1972 ad.
What's going down besides beer?
Both.
Both? Man, I'll turn this place into a car wash.
The Schlitz Malt Liquor Bull. Got more taste than beer. More quality ingredients than premium beer.
Bull does have more taste than beer.
What is the proof that's got more taste for you than your beer, man?
Bull!
No one does it like the Bull.
I'm usually really happy with radio, but that ad makes me really wish that I could see the visuals as well that are taking place. Big Brewery started creating completely separate brands for white and black customers.
Yeah, just a quick point. Those Schlitz small liquor ads are so funky. I mean, I've watched those ads a lot. So one of the people that I was able to talk to was a brewery expert and an academic by the name of J. Nicole Jackson Beckham. And what she told me was that the exact hows are not precise, but there's this, I guess, insider story, if you will. I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth. I don't want to make something seem more discreet than it was. But anyway, the idea is this. There's some market research that appeared when these brewers were trying to figure out, you know, how the heck do we get this otherwise not premium tasting malt beverage into hands, regardless of what they look like. White people aren't buying it. What can we do? So there's this market research that emerges, and it supports or fosters this idea that, let's just say, urban drinkers, you know what that means, buy for cost and they buy for volume and for, I guess, ABV. So that's all kind of related. So basically it's like, okay, what's the cheapest way we can format this in the most economized vessel with this high ABV product? And you have a 40 ounce, and that 40 ounce bottle is what is, as we kind of heard, right, marketed more heavily to an urban demographic. What's weird though, is that all of these malt liquor companies are owned by major breweries. So while you might be living in a predominantly black neighborhood, getting ads for things like Private Stock or Old English, like seeing those billboards or, you know, subway ads or whatever, you're not necessarily seeing, ads for Pabst, like, you know, PBR, I suppose, which is a company that owns Colt 45, right? Molson Coors has Old English in its brand portfolio, but you're not seeing those drinks being consumed in, or at least being advertised actively in those neighborhoods. Let's just be real. I've never seen, even today, a Coors Banquet, you know, the little stubby yellow bottle. I've never seen a Coors Banquet ad featuring a black person. It's like a scavenger hunt quest of this exists. So
why was it that upwardly mobile and middle class black drinkers, maybe folks who lived in the suburbs, did not take the malt liquor tradition with them when they moved?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a failure to take tradition, more so.
Forgive me. You're right.
No, you're all good. Like, but I mean, yeah, it just speaks to the why, to the mysteries of it all. I think it's more not actively engaging. So kind of going back to that advertising thing, right? When you're closing your eyes, thinking about whatever, food or drink or what have you, if you're thinking about beer, you might think of what we talked about at the top of the show, you know, college kids and white dudes and you know, whatever it is, plaid or whatever. When you're thinking about malt liquor, the predominant image that you get when you close your eyes is it's the hood, you know, it's a stereotype, of the person with the 40 ounce hanging on the corner, hanging out on the stoop, the 40 ounce bottle, that's 3.5 beers thereabout, at, you know, upwards of 8-9% ABV. No one is buying a 40. I have bought many a 40 in my lifetime. No one is buying a 40 and drinking a third of it and then putting it in their fridge for later. You know, 21-year-old me in school made that mistake many a time. If you think, you know, malt liquor doesn't taste great, it does not keep anywhere near as well. So it's a product that you know, as I forgot who I was speaking to, but she made the point that it's a product that almost inherently, in a way, you can argue encourages excess, right? And this image of the 40 with a blighted America with a non-bootstrappy black people does not rub a certain, let's just say, upwardly mobile, you know, Cosby showy, ultra respectability politics oriented black America the right way. And they're like, yo, we're making it. We're not going to engage with the food and drink practices of our quote unquote lower class brethren, right? It's a rejection of that. There's some, I was looking at some newspaper articles from the late, this is like the late 80s, late 80s, early 90s, in the Baltimore Sun, right? There are these boycotts for, you know, boycotts against malt liquor and those beverages. There are, I guess, legal action, right, that might be being taken towards those advertisers for pushing that product. Demonstrations that are saying, like, say no to malt liquor and all this stuff. So there's this idea. It's less, to me, it tracked as less, this is bad for black people, and more, in our respectability bubble, we're not going to brook the consumption of Colt 45.
Okay, so to get to the question that started you down this road in the first place, if like Claire Huxtable was not cracking open a 40 when she got home from the law firm, why might she have had Heineken in the fridge when friends came over, and why Heineken rather than Budweiser or Coors or Miller?
Yeah, so again, Budweiser and Coors and Miller, they're not advertising to black people. You know, you're not really seeing melanated faces in those ads. And so basically what you're, I guess what I'm getting at is the reason why Heineken might be in that fridge is because there is a void on how to reach these black folk with disposable income and college degrees. I don't know. There's this, it's like, okay, the beer companies are marketing to them. The beer that they are marketing, malt liquor, is not being purchased by them. What is going on? And so you start to see this, you can argue there's a wave of advertisement from mid-shelf or, you know, premium spirits to a black demographic, right? Hennessy and Remy Ma, you know, certain vodkas, I guess, like Grey Goose, right? I mean, even outside of drink, right? You think about a product like Grey Poupon, which has this, you know, this connotation of worldliness and urbanity and classiness that just is, it's pervasive, right? And it's like, oh yeah, Grey Poupon, like that's the move. And so you can kind of, I guess, play around with that idea a little bit. And it's not too much of a stretch to say that certain beers that were trying to shake up our advertising game, we're getting in on that too. So Heineken, right? That is a Dutch brand, you know, at least originally. And it's like, okay, you know, Coors doesn't want to market to black people. Shoot, you know, we will, you know, and it has this, you know, the green bottle, that mystique of that jet setter lifestyle. It's conspicuous consumption in a way. And there's a prestige that's attached to those bottles. And it's like, it's such an American story that the stuff that's here is like, we're marketing to Americans, and those Americans are a very narrowly defined, you know, looking group of people. And so when other companies are like, well, if you're not going to do it, then we'll hop in to do this too. There you go. There's your answer. At least one of them. Again, nothing. That's what's funny about this story, right? There's so much hunch that's going on. There's so much like, oh, I'm a black guy and I think about this. I wonder if my friends and family might have these thoughts too. I wonder if these academics, I wonder if these industry workers have these thoughts too. And collecting all of this knowledge together in one place and seeing kind of what checks out, seeing what the shared experiences are.
One of the things you learned as you were reporting out this story is about the way history gets preserved or erased by the broader culture, and about the importance in it, for telling some of these stories, in looking at alternative sources. You can't just necessarily go to, you know, the guidebook to beers in America, because it will erase Black contributions.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's so interesting about that is, let's, I've been on brewery tours before, but I've never been on a brewery tour to like a major kind of like brewery before. I have not done that. But I would take a gander personally to say that a tour might not include it might include a lot of the mechanics of what's going on. It might include a lot of the technical aspects of, you know, how to, you know, take the wort and you're putting it into the vat and you're distilling and all that cool stuff, or fermenting and all that cool stuff. Like, that's fine. But what it's not going to include, probably, in my hunch, is the social context around consumption. The social context of, there are people all over the world that are doing this. This is how we do it at insert big brewer here. And yeah, I mean, it's a question, right, of that image of what you see when you close your eyes and you think of beer. When you, I think I have like a beer book around here somewhere, you know, in my jerry-rigged home office. And it's not really providing a lot of context for beers and beer styles that are being produced by people of color, especially and specifically Black people.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Tell us about some of the Black brewers you've gotten to know who have rediscovered the legacy of Black brewing and are cultivating a new generation of beer connoisseurs.
Yeah, so I think earlier on I had mentioned Sankofa Brewing in D.C. When I had started, you know, reporting this out, I was really excited to go and check out the brewery, but then March 2020 happened, which kind of put travel on hold. But like I said, what they're doing is they're bringing in these West African fermentation practices, right, and applying it to quote-unquote American beer. I live in New York. A sad fact is that I think, and I could be wrong, but last I checked, there were 3 Black-owned breweries in the state. All 3 of them are in the city of New York, 2 in Manhattan, 1 in Brooklyn. And what's interesting is now I can just kind of say, oh, you're in New York, go see, go visit a Black-owned brewery or pick up some of their product. You know, there is in Flatbush, where I am, there's Daleview Biscuits and Beer, which, as the name implies, very straightforward. They sell biscuits and beer. The head chef and brewer there, Christopher Ganzi, is from South Carolina. And he wanted to create, you know, he was telling me he wanted to create kind of this space for people to kind of just sit down, right? Sit down to have a conversation, to exchange ideas, I guess, functioning as a bar or a pub in the purest sense. And what I, you know, was able to talk to him about, like, that shop was, he, growing up, he was telling me that beer was around, but it wasn't, you know, the big thing. You know, you might see a Budweiser Tallboy can, but I think he mentioned for his birthday, he got a homebrew kit. And that one kit turned into 2, turned into 3, and just got really invested in this hobby. And it just opens up this world, right? That when, if you're a kid, a Black kid, you might not say, when I grow up, I want to be a brewer. You're like, that's a job. I'm not saying that's necessarily what his experience was, but it was an opening in a way to this thing that could be something that you can kind of hang out with and get better at. You know, I was talking also to the owners of Harlem Hops, Kim Harris, Stacy Lee, and Kevin Bradford, and that's Uptown Shop. And the whole idea is, you know, they're trying to reach out to people in Harlem, to Black folk, and say, I know that you might have this perception that you don't like beer, but we're going to bet you've never had a good beer or beer that you've liked before. You know, I know we're coming up on time, but I remember, and this is very tangentially related, but I remember I was listening to Ta-Nehisi Coates do a talk at this like French Culture Institute about comic books. And he was saying that when people say they don't like comics, that's not what they're saying. What they're saying is they haven't read a comic that really spoke to them, a comic book that they liked. And I think during our conversation, me and the folks up at Harlem Hops, I brought that up. And it's like, yeah, let us, you know, these HBCU grads that have opened up this bar uptown, really, you know, making this connection to Africa's beer past, to explore that history, to share that history, and to invite people that might have felt shut out into the bar to crack one open.
James Bennett II is a staff writer for classical radio station WQXR. His essay, "We're Reclaiming Beer Because It's Ours," appears at the website Eater. James, thank you for talking with us today.
Hey, thank you so much.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.